Hey, what's up, guys? Happy to be back with you for another week of Muscles and Management. Really pumped today to get into everything about loaded sprinting, how we use it, some things that I've learned over the years, the impacts that it has had on our athletes and some of the positives that we get from it. We're talking mechanically speaking, physiologically speaking, in terms of different outputs. We're dispelling some myths that have been around for years, quite frankly, about loaded sprinting that couldn't be more wrong when it comes to just misinforming people and making people afraid of loaded sprints. I think there still is some of us, you know, bit of a stigma around that. Not as much as there used to be. A lot of information out there kind of changing that, but still some people that don't know, that loaded sprints are not only beneficial, but not detrimental to sprint mechanics. So we're going to run through all that, give you insight and just a lot of different things you could take with you to improve your speed training, particularly in acceleration with what you're doing with your athletes or if you're an athlete yourself or whatever it is. So really excited to get into that, and we will dive all into loaded sprints. But first, hit my damn intro music.
This is the Muscles and Management Podcast, where we build your body and your business. Talking all things training, sports performance, and business for athletes and aspiring coaches to enhance your training and better your career. Muscles and Management is brought to you by Challenger Strength with your host, Jerry DiFilippo.
All right, guys. Excited to be here for episode 183 of the Muscles and Management podcast. Like I said, science behind moving slower to get faster. I went with this headline because I think, and this title for the episode, because I think, that has been a concern for people for many years and still might be when it comes to, you know, using loaded sprints to get faster. The idea that, it's something that is getting us to move slower. So, are we really improving our speed if that's the case? And just the idea in general that it's kind of like a paradox, so to speak, that doing something with less speed will help us get more speed. So I think that in my opinion was something just kind of really interesting to go about saying, like, here's this process of us moving slower, but it's going to get us faster. So I think that was kind of what my thought process was on that. Before I get into all that, as I always ask, if you can rate, review, subscribe, you know, all the above, super helpful. Why not try to help me? I'm a nice guy, I think. So that'd be really appreciated. I would really appreciate that if you could do that. I love when you guys share the episode, retweet it. People have been doing that, posting it on their Instagram story. It's really cool to see all the great feedback, from these shows and then how much you guys are enjoying these. So, it makes me really pumped to put these together and, help you guys with as much information as I can with these solo episodes. These really topic driven and dense episodes with a lot of information. So it's been really fun. If you haven't yet, go check out the Baseball Performance Summit. I've been talking about this in a lot of the episodes lately, but a really good collection of some awesome coaches in strength conditioning for baseball that I actually was a part of, and I was really proud to be part of that. I'm going to drop the affiliate link in the show description this week, so if you want to go check that out, you definitely can. But 15 coaches from private sector, college, high school, professional baseball, all talking about all things speed and strength development, when it comes to the baseball players that we work with. So it was a really good group of coaches that I'm pretty sure you would have lifetime access to all of our presentations. So I don't think you can beat that. So go check that out if you haven't already. If you haven't already as well, check out the previous episode of the show, episode 182, a complete guide to in-season programming. Really happy with that, how that turned out. A look inside some of the stuff that we do with our athletes in season, the things that I've learned over the last 6 years and changes that I've made, and a lot of examples with my junior hockey team that basically has a September through March season of near 60 games and practice 5 to 6 days a week. And, what I've learned in terms of steering them through that time of year, some of the tricks, some of the different learning experiences that I've had, even including my first year on the job, putting together a program that was 6 months out with specific exercises and everything, and thinking that I was actually going to be able to get through that in its entirety, and realizing that like 3 days in that wasn't going to work, and all of that. Just if you're a coach or an athlete that is kind of just all over the map or unsure of what to do with in-season training, I think that's a really good episode to listen to. So go check that out if you haven't already. moving and shifting gears a little bit, talking about my week in tweets. So, like I said, enjoy kind of expanding upon some of these tweets. I try to take a look back at the most interacted with ones or the most popular tweets from the week, because I think that, you know, means that people actually really took to them, and I want to definitely explain them a little more. Let's see. First one. Many incorrectly think building strength is all about quote unquote maxing out. It's more about periodization or having a plan, gradual progress, using accurate loads based on prior training, and planned training versus aimless workouts. So I really feel passionate about this. And I think the first thing I want to say is, I think the same athletes that are inconsistent with training are also the same athletes that always want to max out and just try to go for as heavy weight as they can every time they train, because they don't train often enough. It's pretty evident that they're not really athletes that are just totally involved or into the process. Like, you see athletes that are dedicated to it. Like, they enjoy the idea that there's a structured plan that you're building up to a crescendo and testing and seeing your metrics improve over the course of several weeks and all that kind of stuff. Whereas the inconsistent athlete isn't as into that. And as a result, I feel like when they want to train or when they do train, they want that instant feeling of doing something better or lifting more weight than they did the time before, because that's really the only thing that really gets them to be motivated to train, because they're not really into the training itself. They're just more into some of the results that they get. And that's why they have some problems with consistency. So I think that really goes hand in hand. But, you know, you're trying to go into the gym each week and just lift one rep and go heavier and heavier and heavier, you're going to just find yourself spinning your wheels, not really gaining much progress, versus, you know, you got to have a plan, right? So, you know, in a 4 to 6 week or 8 week window, what am I trying to do? What is my strategy in terms of trying to improve my strength? Let's just say we're talking about strength here. You know, just doing one rep over and over again isn't going to do that as much, but, you know, doing 5 reps and then going down to 3 after a couple weeks and then 2, like progressing along that line, or even if you are just doing 5 reps over a 6 week period every week, but trying to gradually add weight to the 5 reps that you're doing, like that is a really good way to start to build some strength. And I think a big part of that is, you know, using accurate loads, because you are tracking what you're doing each week when you train. It's not random, and it's something that you can go back and refer to so that you can make better decisions the weeks to come. So, the previous week I did 250 for 5 on my trap bar deadlift. Maybe I'm going to try to push it to 255 this week. Last week I tried 250 and I barely got it, or I got only 4. Well, I'm going to try 250 again this week. So like, that is one of the most important things that you can do. If you're tracking the loads that you're doing to go along with the plan that you have, and you're gradually trying to improve as time goes by, it goes a long way in building strength. And it's just something that a lot of young athletes need to understand, that it's really not that hard. Just have a plan, have a coach that gives you a plan, stick to that plan. Don't be impatient. Like, I actually have some athletes that don't like to test or like try a vertical or a sprint time or whatever in between when we do it, because they don't want to spoil the results after 6 weeks, right? They want to give it the time, you know, almost like don't pull the cake out of the oven before it's done baking, you know, leave it in there and let it finish. And, you know, it sucks not to have the finished product out yet, but it's way better in the long run to let the process finish and get where it needs to get. And then you'll, you know, you'll be way more satisfied with the end result, right? So patience is a big part of it as well. So I think, you know, that's something really important for athletes to remember, when it comes to that, and just not trying to rush along the process. All right. This is another fun one. I liked, this actually got a response from Tom House saying that he didn't want to retweet it because he thought it would break Twitter. So, I mean, listen, I'm not opposed. Breaking Twitter's fun. Getting a lot of notifications and getting to interact with a lot of people is always a good time. But, I appreciate that he liked it enough to make a joke like that. That means a lot. Especially because, let me read this first and I'll explain why. The most damaging words to athletic development, quote unquote, that's what we did back when I played. So this is just, I like to have fun sometimes with certain tweets, and, you know, there's not always a lot of information, but more so just like short to the point kind of thoughts that I have. And the fact that a guy that has been in the game for as many years as Tom House has been, and has worked with the level of athletes that he's worked with, the fact that he can enjoy this tweet about, you know, that's the way we did things back when I played, and he has been doing this for so many years at such a high level, is really cool, because it just shows that even he is trying to evolve and change things. And I also think that, like, he has had to put up with a lot of people over the years that maybe played the game of baseball. He wasn't a former major leaguer, and you know, had a lot of thoughts on some of the new stuff that he was bringing to pitching development and throwing development with football and baseball players. So I think that like is something he really gravitates towards, because a lot of people kind of went against his teachings for a long time because they were unique and something that really hadn't been done before. But you know, that's a big part of why he had the success that he did, was because he was willing to push the envelope and find new and better ways to do things. Just because you've been doing something for a really long time doesn't mean, it goes both ways. It doesn't mean that you have to change it per se because he's been doing it for a while, but it also doesn't mean that it's going to always be right and we're not going to find better ways to do things. Part of that process is being open-minded to evolving and knowing that maybe something worked or you thought it worked for athletes years ago, but we found something that might work even better, or that we know for a fact works even better, or that we know something we did in the past wasn't optimal. Getting out of that mindset is really, really helpful. And it can be really, it can really hinder progress if we just continue to look at things with hey, 10 years ago, 15 years ago, that's what I did. Things are changing at such a rapid pace. You know, I'm only 27 and, 10 years removed from high school. And, even I know that some of the things that I was taught or some of the things that I did when I was in high school 10 years ago are just not ideal, based on like what we know now or what even I've learned, what I would have done differently when I was at that age. So I think it's really important to just kind of leave our ego and pride to the side, to not be lazy and not just say, hey, just because we've done something for many years and it doesn't require us to do any critical thinking to find new ways to do stuff. We don't have to really test it or just see if it actually does work. I think we have to push beyond that if we're expecting to make the developmental strides that we would hope to make. So that's a really big one. And, I'm happy that that was well received, because I think it's really important to talk about. Last but not least, coaches, you should absolutely have programming templates. Every new athlete you work with, you decide what base program they match with best and you tweak from there. Then you individualize loading, make changes that are needed, etc. The best way to streamline your process. So for coaches, I think this was a big one to share, because I think coaches need to put a little bit less pressure on themselves with this whole idea of individualization. Like, you're never going to be able to help as many athletes as you possibly can by having to start over and make a brand new training program every time you get an athlete. And it's also really inefficient and doesn't take advantage of the good work that you've done in the past. If I've been training athletes for 5 or 6 years and, I've basically seen as big of a variety as you possibly could have seen, with younger athletes, older athletes, different groupings of athletes among that scale that they look like they relate to this kid that I've worked with or whatever. And I can't go back and use the template from an athlete I think they relate to kind of be the starting point for them that I can then tweak from there. I'm never going to have a process that is just, feasible. I'm going to be pulling my hair out how much time I have to spend doing things. And not only does it limit the reach that you can have to more athletes because you have a better process, but it also just puts an undue amount of work on you as a coach and stress on you as a coach. And the more you can streamline your programming process, the more energy you'll have to actually coach and be on the floor helping people. Or if you're a coach who has a business, the more time you can have to, get out and grow the business and do creative stuff and things like that. So I think it's really important to understand that individualization, as I've said before, isn't as much as, every athlete having 60 different exercises, but, you make tweaks here and there, you have templates, but you start to make the choice of what the loads are going to be in terms of difference in loading. And then you help the athlete with the progression of that. Or, you make tweaks here and there at the outline or structure of a training week or whatever it is in the breakdown. I think it's really important to make sure that you understand that that is a good process to have and a normal process to have. And if you aren't doing that type of stuff, you're going to have a really hard time trying to serve more athletes, especially if you're in school settings. So I really wanted to make sure I hit on that, because I think a lot of coaches put undue stress and pressure on themselves, thinking that everything has to be like started from scratch with every individual athlete that they train. All right, last but not least, when it comes to tweets for this week, we have my follower tweet of the week. This comes from Luke Hare, at Professor Hare. Hey, really appreciate all you put out there. I noticed your isometrics tweet with our guys starting in season. I'm looking for a good hybrid lift with these types of lifts. Was wondering how many sets you would do for these. So to keep this pretty simple, and we're talking about the overcoming isometrics here, I would liken that to, however many sets you would think you're going to do of a traditional 5 rep or 3 rep or whatever many rep strength lift. You would do a similar amount of sets for the overcoming ISOs. So that's pretty simple. And then I kind of developed this over just trial and error, a 2 seconds of isometric tension per rep of planned lift. So if I plan on doing a 5-rep set, we would do a 10-second isometric. A 3-rep set would be 6. 2 would be a 4-second iso, and so on and so forth. That's kind of just what I kind of determined based on like a goal of time under tension, on how long the average 5-rep or 3-rep set would take. And I think it's just a matter of substituting, those in for the normal amount of reps and sets you would have for your strength work. And you just don't really want to overthink it. Like, it can be just as simple as that. You know, overcoming isos, as I've mentioned in these posts, can be really helpful when you're in season and you want to limit some soreness that your athletes might deal with, but also, you know, still get those force output or power output desires or adaptations that you're seeking can be a really good tool. So if you look through my Twitter or my Instagram, I have a whole post on that, a video that goes along with that. You know, as well. And maybe, you know, someday I'll do a whole episode on that. So that was a great question. And I'm glad that that post also got a lot of good feedback and was pretty helpful to, you know, a lot of the coaches and athletes that came across it. All right. So moving to today's topic, loaded sprinting. Like I said, the science behind moving slower to get faster. So the biggest thing I want to start with in this conversation is some of the myths associated with loaded sprinting that I think can be pretty damaging to the idea of using loaded sprints to get faster, and you know what some coaches might be leery of, or athletes might be leery of because of these things. So I think the first one we need to address is the idea that you need to move fast to get fast. Believe me when I tell you, you know, I am a big believer in intent and, you know, sprinting at full speed and resting long enough and not turning sprints into conditioning. Like, I talk about all of this stuff on a daily basis on social media, but I also think there's got to be some kind of balance between that and, you know, the fact that you're thinking you're never going to get fast unless you're doing something fast. Like, that's the only way you're going to get faster. Now, a lot of coaches and athletes need to go to the extreme of believing that because they do things too slow or they turn sprints to conditioning and all that kind of stuff. But the idea that something that is not performed at maximum speed is going to make you not make you faster is something we have to get past. And for two reasons. One, doing things at sub-max speeds to work on mechanics, right? So tempo runs. I know Brendan Thompson talks about this all the time. He's a really good sprint coach that I'm pretty good friends with, about the idea of, you know, fine-tuning mechanics. And we talk about extensive plyometrics and all of these different things that are really helpful in terms of building speed. And I think the other part of that too is, if you are always going into things with the idea that the only way you're going to get better is moving fast, you can only do so many really fast repetitions in a training day or a training week before the effect starts to be minimalized. So we do have to also find ways to get faster in things that aren't as intense. So like we said, the extensive plyos, the slower sprints or drills to work on mechanics and stuff like that. Like, that's number one. Number two, you know, thinking that doing something with a load, like a loaded jump or a loaded sprint, like, isn't going to make you faster because it's slower because there's a load attached to it, right? I think that just pretty much, you know, throws the entire force velocity curve and continuum out, you know, the window, and you're not considering that, which is pretty foolhardy. You have to remember that when it comes to power output, there is that continuum of how much of that is contributed by force production. So force output and heavier expression of movement, or a little bit slower expression of movement, more towards up the curve to velocity, which is pure speed expression. And when it comes to speed, there is a degree of speed that can be improved by increasing your ability to produce force, right? So if we're doing something that is allowing us to produce more force in our speed movements, we might be doing something that's making us move slower, but we're doing that thing that is making us move slower to build a quality that will help us in our fast movement, right? So, you know, you're putting a loaded sled on an athlete to get them better at an attribute that will contribute to their maximum speed sprinting, right? Number two, you can use a weight vest to do loaded sprinting. So I tweeted about this the other night, and it was just like a thought that I had. I was just kind of chilling, and I was just thinking about stuff that, you know, thoughts passed through my mind. And just the question that I've gotten from a lot of people about whether or not you can use a weight vest to get faster, or, you know, I've been getting or trying to get into TikTok more and seeing a lot of kids ask that question, you know, hey, I don't have a sled. If we, you know, if I make a post about sled sprints, can I use a weighted vest instead or whatever it is? And I think that's just something that we really need to cross off right off the bat. The weighted vest is not the same as a regular loaded sprint. And the reason for that is where the load is applied, right? So when you do use a weighted vest, and you put a weighted vest on, the weight is on top of your body. So it is applying load down. So like in the vertical force vector, right? When you sprint, although there are vertical, force outputs at play, which is a big part of what I always talk about with top speed training, the overall goal obviously is net horizontal propulsion, right? You're trying to go forward. So while you're striking the ground down or you're doing things that do have vertical implications, your overall goal is to move forward. The best that you can do to project yourself to go forward, right? So if you have a weighted vest on and it's pulling down on you, it's not really getting you to apply force going forward. You're going to apply force going forward anyway, but, it's pulling down on you, not behind you. We need weight behind us. Weight behind us makes us put more force to go forward, right? And that's what we're trying to improve is our way. We're trying to project force going forward, right? And on top of that, mechanically speaking, it doesn't really do anything for us. The weight behind us has to make us shift into better body angle, and it has to make us get positive shin angle and contact behind our hip to in order to pull that weight forward. And I actually had an athlete, do a repetition with a weighted vest on today for a video I wanted to put together explaining this. And I asked him how he felt afterwards, just out of curiosity. And he was like, yeah, I just feel heavier. Like, I don't really feel the effect that I get from a loaded sprint that's getting me to pull and exert force going forward because of the weight that's behind me. And the weight behind you is amplifying the amount of force and display force you're putting in generally to push yourself forward. More weight behind you makes you put even more force in to go that direction. Just like more weight in your hands or on your body or whatever would resist you in a loaded jump to input more force going vertically. You wouldn't do you wouldn't work on a loaded broad jump with a weight vest, right? You want the weight behind you because you're trying to pull forward. You wouldn't work on a loaded jump with weight behind you because you're trying to get weight on top of you to make you exert more force up, right? So these are important things that we need to consider when you think of the type of implements we are going to be using to do loaded sprints. And last but not least, you should only do loaded sled sprints with light weight. So this was something that was believed to for a long time. I remember Joe DeFranco actually talking about it on his podcast about loaded sprinting way back when I listened to it. And the idea that many athletes or many coaches thought that, you know, if you did a loaded sprint, it had to be with a super light weight because a heavier weight would impact your mechanics negatively. And the light weight was the only way to go. And I remember Cam Joss talking about, you know, many people thinking that it was a load that should be maybe roughly 7 to 20% of your body weight versus the heavier loads that we found. And I'll get to the studies about what those loads are. But that was also a big mistake too, thinking that it was only needed to be lighter. While there is a benefit to some lighter loaded sprinting in terms of top speed, because when you're getting closer to top speed, obviously there's more velocity associated with that. It's a higher velocity movement because your body's already moving and exerting forces at higher speeds. There is a benefit to doing a lighter loaded sprint in those portions of your sprints if you're trying to improve the overall rate of force development that you're producing. However, when it comes to acceleration, it needs to be heavy, frankly, if we're trying to get the effect that we're looking to yield from the exercise itself. So that's a big mistake, is thinking that you need to do it with lightweight or should only be with lightweight. And I said last but not least, but actually one more. Loaded sprinting can ruin your mechanics. So obviously that lightweight thought process with the sled sprinting did come from the idea that many coaches were incorrectly fearing the idea that a loaded sprint would ruin mechanics, due to the nature of the load just being different from what the athlete was used to. And we actually you find the opposite. And I'm going to get into this now. It's my next thing I want to talk about. I'll just take a drink. I will tell you, that's the one thing about these solo podcasts that's very different than having guests on, is like, if I have a guest on and I turn something over to them or I ask them a question, they can very easily just speak and I can mute my microphone and I can start to, you know, take a sip of water or something. I'm telling you, when you are doing these solo episodes, and I've tried to break them up a little bit. Like, I'll record some segments. Like even if I sit down and I do it all in one night, I'll, you know, sit down, do the first couple minutes of an intro, go to the bathroom, sit down, do the rest, like give myself breaks, you know, even if it's only a 45-minute episode, like I think I actually have set records with Q&As that I've done for like an hour and 15 minutes, hour and 20 minutes straight, but it's not pleasant. You just like keep talking and, you know, it is just a stream of consciousness that never ends. And it's pretty tough to do. But yeah, no, I could like take a sip of water if I had a guest on the show, but obviously now, you know, I have to take a pause and do that. And I don't like to, you know, edit that stuff out because I think it's more authentic. Like if, and I've listened to these shows before, you got a Joe Rogan, not that I'm a Joe Rogan by any means, but you have these other podcasters that like, they're, that is part of the process. Like we're human beings. We take drinks. Like I'm not a friggin' machine that's just spewing out 80 words a minute. You know, just as fast as I possibly can. So anyway, let's get off of that tangent. Mechanical benefits of loaded sprinting. So I talked about the idea that many coaches incorrectly feared that heavy loaded sprinting could ruin mechanics. And it actually is the opposite. Not only does it not ruin them, but it is a lot of things to promote the quality mechanics that we're looking to have. So basically the way you have to look at it is the mechanical aspect is that the certain things that we look for, right? So I'll name some of the things that we look for in acceleration in terms of mechanics. We talk about this all the time, but we got body angle. So we talked about body angle, you know, forward lean, you know, making sure it's not the idea of, you know, bending over at the waist to get quote unquote low. I think that's one of the most like damaging cues you can give a young athlete in particular who doesn't really know much about sprinting. You know, it's not getting low. It's creating an angle. You know, we talk about foot contact behind the hip. We talk about positive shin angle. So that goes along with the body angle, you know, projecting forward on an incline going forward. So vertical shin angle would be a shin that is straight up and down. Positive shin angles, if that shin shifted forward and was like on a 45 degree type of projection, you know, that's more of what we're looking for. Better extension. So we talk about the acceleration. We're going to have longer, extensions of our strides just to be able to exert more force and all that type of stuff, right? When you have a load behind you, it is almost physically impossible to not get into these positions, right? If I try to sprint standing straight up with a sled weight behind me, I am not going to be able to pull it. Like it's literally impossible, right? If I contact the ground in front of my hips and my foot lands in front of my body when I'm doing a sled sprint, I'm going to stumble forward and fall. If I don't have positive shin angle, and that goes hand in hand with the foot contact behind the hip, if that's not happening with a sled behind me, I won't be able to pull it. And if I do, it'll be very awkward and I will literally face plant and fall on my face, right? And the extension part of it too, and that this could go into a little bit more of the output benefits, but, if I have weight behind me and I'm trying to sprint, and I don't get quality extension, I'm not going to also be able to pull that load. I have to get full extension through my drive leg when it contacts the ground to be able to pull the excess weight behind me. All of these things seamlessly happen with loaded sprinting because the weight in terms of physics makes you actually have to, you literally have to get into these positions, right? So not only does it not negatively impact your mechanics, it's actually doing things to positively impact those mechanics, right? So it's like the complete opposite direction on that. And I think the other part about it that I really enjoy is we talk about skill development all the time, right? In terms of, you know, unconscious incompetence. So you don't know that you're doing something wrong. And then getting an athlete to understand what they're doing maybe incorrectly or that's not as optimal in terms of their movement needs, and making them aware of that. So that's conscious incompetence. So now they kind of understand what maybe they're not doing the correct way. And then you want to get to conscious competence, which is, you know, you're doing things better, but you have to kind of put some thought into it. And then eventually to unconscious competence, which is, you know, I'm getting to positions like, you know, an elite sprinter in track and field in the Olympics isn't thinking about driving their foot back behind their hip when they sprint, when they're running. It's just, it's happening, right? I think loaded sprints are a really good way to kind of bridge the gap to conscious competence, unconscious, where you don't have a choice. The sprint is being executed in a way that's more ideal because of the load that's behind you. So you're not sitting there thinking, put the foot here, get the body this way, whatever. You have to get to that point because of the sled. So it allows you to get repetitions done in better positions, which I think is really important in terms of building that bridge to behavior that just kind of happens seamlessly. So that's another big part of it too. When it comes to the output benefits of loaded sprinting, that is a really big part of it as well. You know, we're looking at the force production benefit of, loaded sprinting. That is basically the idea where, you know, we have that load behind us and it's going to force us, no pun intended, to exert more force, into our sprint, right? So if I have weight behind me, when I put my foot in the ground, I have to exert more, and I need to do a better job of putting more into the ground because I have more weight behind me that I have to move. Just like a loaded jump is the same idea. I have dumbbells in my hands, whatever it is, I'm trap bar, whatever I'm using, it's making me put more into the ground because naturally when I have more weight, I have to exert more to move that weight. Along with that is the idea of longer ground contact time. So I think a lot of athletes incorrectly rush their ground contact times when it comes to acceleration. You get choppy feet and they're very rushed. I think longer ground contact time is something that the output part of it, because you need to have your foot on the ground longer. Acceleration is characterized by longer ground contacts versus top speed, which is a little bit faster. But longer ground contact times, you have that sled, to exert more force, your foot needs to be on the ground for a longer amount of time. So it's getting the athletes in the habit of not rushing their stride. That's another big one. Static force production into a start. One of the easiest ways to improve your start is to improve your ability to put as much force into the ground as humanly possible to get yourself moving from a position of no momentum. So you're not really moving into that. So you're putting that force into the start, driving into that lead leg, and it's really getting you better at exerting all of that force to get going. That is the number one way to improve your start, not the idea of just rapidly moving your feet. You want to press into that front leg to really get things moving. And then last but not least, and this could be maybe more moderate load, so not on the super, super heavy side of things, but the rate of force development side of it. If we are using a sled, it is improving our ability to exert more force more rapidly. So part of speed is, we want to make our strides go one to the next faster, but we also want to exert force more efficiently. So in a shorter amount of time, if I can exert more force in a shorter amount of time over months and months and months of training, odds are I'm going to be faster, right? So that's another big one. Before I get into some general loading principles, I do want to touch on a couple of things that you do want to make sure you're not doing, when you're doing loaded sprints. The biggest one, and this is a really good indication, they might be using a weight that's too heavy or too heavy for the athlete to handle. Look at the occurrences of their ground contact. So if the strides become really, really choppy and, start to get where it's one foot, next foot, and it's like really one after the other pretty quick, what that means is the sled's too heavy where they're not able to move it with one foot exerting force into the ground, and they need to have their other foot quickly contact the ground at the same time. A little bit of that might be okay if you're starting to get a little bit heavier in your loads, but if the athlete can barely lift, have one foot on the ground while the other one's not, it's just not going to be pretty, right? You need to make sure that the load is not too heavy, where you're going to have that problem arise, and it's a really easy one to kind of snuff out right away. And then last but not least, in terms of the things you don't want to see, is hunching over, bending over, that get low idea. If that starts to happen, it might be too heavy as well, where the athlete has to lean too much because the load is too heavy for them to actually pull. All right. So now that we got the mechanical things out of the way, I do want to talk about some general loading principles, because I think that this is a big part of it too. I want to say first and foremost, I think it's important to stress that if you don't have a sprint timer, you can still be doing loaded sprints. I think, and I get aggravated by this because, like I mentioned about TikTok, and maybe I'm an idiot for letting TikTok bother me, but like, you try to put content out there that helps everybody, and you understand that not everybody or most people aren't going to have a laser sprint timer, to do their loaded sprinting. So you try to tell people, hey, here's a general, idea of a way that you can use body weight to figure out a sled load, right? So a 200-pound athlete, let's just say you wanted to do a little bit on the lighter side, you could go 85%. And, I think 85% body weight is a good place to start for a beginner. Going too heavy can start to have an adverse impact on mechanics if they're not ready yet. But you multiply 0.85 times 200 and you get your number, right? Like, that's a really good way if you don't have a sprint timer to kind of give yourself a general idea of what that athlete should be doing. And keep it simple. Over the course of time, you could start at 85%, and let's say that's how much? 85% times 200. Let's do that math real quick. Password in my phone. All right. So that would give us 170 pounds, right? The athlete does that for, let's say, 10 weeks. And I could just make the general assumption that the mechanics are getting better because they're getting more comfortable. They're getting stronger with not only the sprints, but everything else we're doing in programming. So I'm going to just bump them up to 180. Like, I'm just going to add 10 pounds, right? What I'm trying to do there is I'm just trying to say, like, I am aiming to improve the force produced in that shorter amount of time. And I'll explain what I mean by that later. But, you know, you're gradually making that improvement. And I want coaches and athletes to understand that you can and should be doing loaded sprints, even if you cannot find a weight based on your max sprint time due to not having a laser sprint system, right? Circling back a little bit, though, and I've alluded to this before on various things that I've done, but the study from JB Marin and Matt Cross, I think it was 2017, found that 66 to 96% of body weight was an ideal weight for resisted sprinting, or at least like the bare minimum, you know, the lower percentage of that, maybe a little bit closer to rate of force production. And that's just kind of the same idea that we would do with any velocity-based training on a barbell or loaded jumps or whatever. The slightly lower percentages are a little bit faster, and that's more rate of force production, where the higher percentage is closer or more like that accelerative strength window that we talked about in last week's or 2 weeks ago in the velocity-based training episode, is more of that accelerative strength force-producing window. So that was the first study that was brought to my attention. I mentioned Cam Joss on Joe DeFranco's podcast a few years back. You know, the idea that for many years people thought that the ideal range would be that more 7 to 20% body weight range. They found in their study with a group of athletes or several groups of athletes that that 66 to 96% body weight range was used and yielded improvements in their time. It wasn't to the detriment. It didn't make them slower. It didn't ruin their mechanics. Obviously, they're not slower. And if they're not slower, odds are their mechanics are more optimal, generally speaking. You know, that is really what started to turn the wheels of this heavier loading when it comes to acceleration, at least for me. You know, people had been doing them for years. Joe had alluded to on that, you know, episode that these are things that they had been doing for years at DeFranco's, but they didn't really have a study. And that's kind of how these things go, right? Like the study comes along later to verify the things that we already had been doing sometimes. I used to go for anywhere from like 65 to 95% body weight. I just basically took the reins that they had and I started to just kind of implement it in a way where when I wanted a little bit lighter of a load and, you know, you still wanted the load there, but you wanted to work more on force production, rate of force production, you would go 65% body weight and then 75, 85, 95, all the way up the scale there, kind of like you would with the force velocity curve and how I've discussed what we do with, you know, loaded vertical jumps with, you know, jumping 15% of your max height being the really force dominant type of loaded jump, 25 or 35% being more in that strength speed window, all the way up to, you know, maybe 50% of your 55% of your max jump height being more speed strength in a loaded jump. I had the same mindset with the loaded sprint. However, we no longer really go below 85% in our 10-yard sprint work. And just because we found that anything below this mark really does not promote enough force production to be beneficial in any area, you know, in this area of the sprint particularly. And that was just more from different people I had talked to, different practitioners, coaches and researchers, just finding that, when it comes to acceleration specifically, you don't even want to waste your time with those lower percentages because you can get results, but you'll get even better results in that first 10 because of how force dominant it is, force dominant comparatively to the rest, of sprinting, that, you know, that higher percentage of body weight. So we really stick to 85, 105, 85% for beginners. I feel like 105 might be too much sometimes for them and they might have trouble mechanically speaking. If you're starting with 85%, it's a good place to start and you can gradually increase as you go. Even if you go up to 105%, like your first, you know, cycle doing that. And let's say it was 200 pounds on the sled. That's not to say that even if the athlete doesn't gain any weight in 2 months, they can't be doing 210 pounds on the sled. Cause the natural thought process there would be that they're doing this, they're getting stronger, more explosive, so they can handle more weight and exert more force in a shorter amount of time because of that. Right. So that's a really big one. If we want to start to look at the specifics of loading based on time, it's more complicated, but it is more accurate as well. And this is what I talked about being frustrated with TikTok, because certain people on there would say, hey, like this is a good starting point, but it doesn't account for when I talked about body weight percentages for loaded sprints. This is a good starting point, but it doesn't really account for the different friction of different surfaces or different implements and different sleds and all that kind of stuff. You know, and really what it comes down to at that point is, like I said, it's just a start. If you want to start to actually find loads for your sled sprints that factor all of that in and are based on the actual surface that you're sprinting on, because 65% on one person's or 85% on one person's turf could be something completely different than 85% on another person's turf, the different sleds and all that kind of stuff, right? What you want to do if you have a free lap or a way to measure a brow or whatever it is to measure sprint speeds with a laser, because in a 10-yard sprint, a stopwatch maybe gives you a rough estimate, but it's such a small or short distance, and there's so much human error with a stopwatch that, you know, a couple tenths of a second or 1/10 of a second or 2/10 of a second is a major deal in a 10-yard sprint. It's a major difference. You know, a 4.45 to a 4.6 in a 40 isn't as significant as a 1.5 to a 1.6 in a 10, right? That's a big deal. So the stopwatch generally isn't worth your time to even waste your time on that. If you have a laser system you can use, you want to find the max time, your max sprint time, your best time without a sled. We do like to use 6 sprints for an average, and the reason I like to do that is it gets rid of outliers. It gives you a general idea of the athlete's complete body of work at that time, not the best time that they're going to have or the worst, but it identifies them as the sum of the whole and of all those parts. From there, the zone that we generally like to sit in is at 15 to 25% of max speed. And I really, like, even as time goes by in an off season, don't really change that. Like, we're still going to go pretty heavy later in the off season. What might change in later in the off season is how I pair those. So I might like do more of a contrast split, whatever it is. But my old mindset would be to lower the weight as we go along through the off season, because I wanted things to move faster. But finding that when you're only working with 10s, it doesn't really point to that. To continue to get improvements in that 10, you want to continue to work, like I said, in that 15 to 25% of max speed. Give yourself that 10% wiggle room, because you can get a little lighter if you want a little more force production. But generally speaking, it's not as beneficial to go lighter than that, meaning like any faster than 25% of your max time. Meaning we're trying to find weight that gets us to only sprint between 15 to 25% of our max time. So if I'm going to say, hey, I want to make sure that I'm doing a loaded sprint and only sprinting at 15% of my max time, it's the equivalent of saying I only want to jump 15% of my max vertical. Or I want when you do a barbell for velocity-based training, you say I'm going to do 85% of my max, right? So that's 85% is 15 away from 100. So I flipped it basically, and you're using a reduced percentage of your speed to find the weight that you want, whereas you use the weight to find the speed in velocity-based training. So we're going to get our time. Let's say it's a 1.55 10-yard sprint is the athlete's average, right? So what I'm going to do to find out what 15% of my max speed is, what time that would be, I multiply by 1.85. And the reason I do that is, like I said, 85 from 100 is 15. So times 1.85, I get a time of 2.867, right? So running my 10-yard sprint in 2.867 means I'm running at 15% of my max speed, right? So it's got to be a lesser time. I mean, I want it to be slower, right? If I were to do 1.2 or 1.75, that would get me 25% of my max time. So now I'm looking at maybe a 2.7. So that's a little bit faster, right? So it's not as heavy or as slow, because I want it to be run at 25% of my max time versus 15%. But what I'm doing is I'm finding the goal time based on my unloaded sprint. So let's say we're going 15% here, and I said it's around a 2.81. I'm going to keep on putting weight on a sled until I run the sprint and get to a 2.81. I try to roughly, if I want a 2.81, anywhere from like 2.75 to 2.9 is fine. And the reason that for that is that there's going to be ebbs and flows. They get into the ground in their start. Was it a good rep? Like, there's going to be some volatility there. If we're within 0.15, odds are on average we'll be right around the mark that we're looking for in that 2.8 range. So we're going to continue to check. This is what we call fitting the athlete for their sled load. And this is where we're going to try to find the load that they need to run at that goal time. What's really cool about that is, you know, we can track progress by saying, you know, in August, the athlete was running 15% of their max speed with 200 pounds, right? But by November or December, they're running at 25% or 15% of that max time, or maybe even a little bit faster with 215 pounds on the sled. So what that's telling us is they are getting better. They're exerting more force in as much time or a shorter amount of time than they were, which bodes very well for acceleration and has been big for us in terms of the improvements that we're seeing with our acceleration times and overall 10-yard sprint testing. We've had some great results of the last few months using more and more of this type of protocol as we've gotten our free lap, and it's been really, really good for us in terms of our results. So you're trying to find a weight that ensures we are moving slowly enough to actually be using a load that will elicit the force production gains we're looking to see. So it just means that we're actually trying to find a load that is heavy enough to get us to exert the force that we are actually trying to exert. If we're not going heavy enough, we're not exerting as much force as we might want to, which isn't going to get us the force output gains that are really big in improving acceleration times and lowering 10-yard sprint times, right? From there, to finish up, other tools that might be helpful for building sprint speed and acceleration that can go along with this. Not only can we do or sled sprints or heavier sled sprints, but sled drags or pulls or pushes. This is even heavier, maybe several hundred pounds, 500, 600, 700 pounds. This is a really almost like strength training in the presence of a sprint pattern where you're doing a unilateral, push your one foot into the ground and build out pure raw absolute strength force production like we would with a heavy lift. Really beneficial for that, for especially for younger athletes that can, get a lot out of improving speed by just improving their overall force because they're not that strong. Also does a really good job of improving ankle stiffness. When you're talking about acceleration and elite accelerators, when you look at when they make contact with the ground, it's through the more of the ball of their foot, and you're looking at the space between their heel and the ground. The heel's not collapsing. A collapsing heel is inefficient. It lengthens our contact time per where it needs to be. If we can contact the ground through the ball of our foot under our hip, we're immediately contacting the ground and simultaneously going into our next stride. Collapse of the heel is not ideal with that. And a heavy sled, we're going to get up on our toe and push, and it's really strengthening and giving us more resilience around the Achilles and all that back of the ankle area into the calf, which is going to be very beneficial for our acceleration. And we've seen a lot of improvement in athletes in terms of doing that with the heavy sleds, drags, and pushes. That has really transferred well over to what their ground contacts look like when we're taking slow-mo video of their first couple strides. The ground contacts, like I said, are through more of the ball of the foot because of the extreme angle of the shin and the body and where the foot's landing behind the hip. And we can be, really making some big improvements in those contacts if we are doing some of these heavier sled drags and sled pushes. Last but not least, the last two, overcoming isometrics. So getting up against the wall and doing a sprint iso, one leg forward, one leg back, pressing into the ground, into the wall as hard as you can. A really good way to groove mechanics and positions, but also get the athlete really good at exerting a lot of force in a short amount of time, which, as I've said, is beneficial for that static, that start from a static position. And then lastly, if you want to start to blend, band release variations, and what that does is it gets you to exert that isometric into the front side where then you can let it go and go into a sprint. So you're getting the athlete to feel push into that front side, but then letting it go and going into a regular unloaded sprint. Or we've done variations like band walkout sprints where you're pressing into the front foot, walking maybe into a couple strides and then releasing it, and that kind of blends it a little bit better. So those are also some tools that we can use, with the loaded sprints. But that's all I have for you guys today. I really do hope that was helpful. I'm pretty happy with all that we got through. I do think there's a lot you can take from this right away and apply into your training. Remember, as I said, you don't have to have a sprint timer to do loaded sprints. You can use body weight ranges and percentages, use your eyes, see how the athlete responds to the load that you're giving them, if they can handle it. And just over the, weeks and months that you train, try to add a little weight here, add a little bit there. And, the hope is that you gradually get better at exerting more force in a shorter amount of time, which is ultimately going to improve that acceleration and drop your 10-yard sprint times and improve. So I hope you guys enjoyed this one. Give me feedback, post about it, tag me, whatever it is, share it. And I will talk to you guys next time. Peace.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Muscles in Management brought to you by Challenger Strength. I'm your host, Jerry DiFilippo, signing off from the show that's changing how we view sports performance, training, and business.